Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger with Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Thanks for joining us. Coming up today on the show, we'll have more on the political firestorm going on among mostly Republican lawmakers in response to the president's threat to impose tariffs on Mexican goods. That's starting Monday. And a Valley fashion designer will have one of his dresses on the red carpet this weekend at the Tony Awards. This is also our summer edition of the show. From now until Labor Day, the show will be zeroing in on our state and region with a one-hour program from 9 until 10. So keep sending us those Arizona story ideas. We are at the show at kjzz.org.
But first, the drama between APS and the Arizona Corporation Commission is continuing as commission staffers are recommending APS rates get an official reexamination. It's all surrounding a battle related to whether the utility wasn't fully forthcoming about how individual customer rates would be affected by a change in rate plans. Some have seen a reduction, while others have been hit hard by higher costs. Arizona Republic reporter Ryan Randazzo is with us for more details. Ryan, good morning.
Morning.
So, Ryan, where are we at in terms of what this actually means? So staff of the Corporation Commission is recommending this. What are the steps? How much is the timeline here?
Well, the staff is recommending that APS file a rate case by October 31st. I have a hard time imagining that the commissioners are going to oppose that. I think they're very likely to order that rate case. There's going to be some debate over what time period that covers. But I guess what we can expect is, you know, a rate case to be filed sometime later this year. And then what's usually about a 12-month process before regulators decide on what to do, whether to raise them, lower them, and maybe alter the rate plans.
Is there a timeline typically how often APS or any other utility would ask for a rate case situation? How often does that happen?
Well, more recently, it's common that they get their final rate decision after about a year of negotiations, and then there's a stay out, and that's part of the negotiations. And the stay out means, you know, they're ordered, they say you can't file another rate case before such and such date. It's usually about 18 to 24 months. But sometimes, as is happening now, the commissioners and staff decide that they don't want to wait, that they'd really like to see the company sooner.
So we have a new commissioner, Leah Marquez Peterson. I know it's probably too soon to tell, but based on her past, is there any indication she would vote any differently on reopening or dealing with a rate case than Andy Tobin would have?
Well, it's going to be interesting because she has to run for election to keep that seat that she was appointed to. And I think it's going to be difficult for anyone to win election to the Corporation Commission if they are seen as being friendly towards APS. So I'm not positive that she's going to get to vote next week. I would think she is, but you know, that could mean that someone who has to run for office, their first decision is a major one dealing with the state's biggest utility and something that could be controversial as the election nears.
So that's striking what you just said there about how about the next election and how politics are playing into this, Ryan. Like, how much has this changed just in the last couple of election cycles?
Well, there's a lot more scrutiny on the Corporation Commission today. There's no doubt about that. And that goes back several years to having, you know, one commissioner resign at the direction of the attorney general. Another one brought up on federal corruption charges. Another one in a text messaging snafu where the public records request couldn't be answered because the phone was thrown away. And, you know, the commission is just under a ton of scrutiny. And now you have this major challenge to APS's rates. So you've got all the customers paying attention. It definitely seems a lot more political to me. And I don't want to imply that the decision is going to be based entirely on politics. But I've got to think that's in the back of the commissioner's minds at this point.
Ryan, have you had a chance to talk with Stacey Champion, the local activist who was involved in trying to get APS to have to reopen this rate case?
Well, I haven't spoken with her since she got a decision by the commissioners to not dismiss her case, which was not a loss for her, but also not exactly what she was looking for. But I think, you know, her complaint is definitely the reason why the commissioners were continuing to look at APS's rates and why the staff has now recommended that the company come back for a rate case.
Any response from APS on this? This is not great news for them, I'm sure.
I think that that's not necessarily true, because they get to now plead their case in front of commissioners again in a forum that they're more accustomed to, a rate case rather than a rate complaint. And I don't think they're going to come back and say, yeah, lower our rates. They're going to get to make a request, and I'm sure that's going to be for higher rates. They've they spent money in New Mexico on a coal plant, and they expected to be charging customers for those upgrades at this point. That's been delayed because of the Champion complaint. So I think they're going to come in and ask for that money. They're going to ask for a rate increase, I would expect. If they don't, that'll be the headline, that they come in and voluntarily say, lower our rates. I just don't predict that's what they're going to say.
Fair enough. All right. Arizona Republic reporter Ryan Randazzo, thank you for joining us.
Have a great day.
The Trump administration is one day closer to implementing tariffs on all imports from Mexico. That's after meetings led by Vice President Mike Pence and Mexico's Foreign Relations Secretary at the White House yesterday. For more on this, we're joined now by Jorge Valencia. He's on the line from our Mexico City Bureau. Good morning, Jorge.
Hey, Lauren.
Okay, so do we know what the two sides talked about at their meeting yesterday?
Yes, we do. They met for 2 hours, and the sole topic of conversation was immigration to the U.S. border. Now, what that means is that they didn't discuss tariffs, which is very interesting, considering that at the heart of this drama that we're seeing unfold this week are the tariffs. But Mexico's Foreign Relations Secretary, Marcelo Ebrard, he gave a short briefing after their meeting. He said that they focused on immigration, that that's really the only thing that's on the table this week. And he said that he was optimistic about the way that the meetings turned out.
We had the opportunity to share our point of view, explained why the Mexican position is regarding this issue. So that's why I am optimistic.
And also to add, we also heard a little more from the U.S. administration after the call, and it was from President Trump. He tweeted a couple hours after the meeting adjourned, and he said that he sees progress, but Mexico's not doing enough, and that he is planning to start implementing tariffs next week.
So the big question through all of this tariff debate is what exactly President Trump is after. Like, what is he saying that he wants and that he'll do if that doesn't happen?
I still haven't been able to get full clarity on that, and I don't know if anybody outside of that room, or even inside of that room, to be honest, has been able to tell. The president, at least publicly, and his surrogates have said that they want Mexico to do much more and to increase its enforcement so that people aren't getting to the U.S. Now, there isn't anything to indicate that what they're asking for is for a full 100% stop so that nobody gets to the U.S. border. But if that is actually the case, I think Mexico and Democrats and probably many Republicans in Congress and certainly many immigration experts, people who follow this for a living, say that that would be wildly unrealistic expectation. And so Mexico says that they have been doing a lot. They are on track to deport more than twice as many people than they deported in any of the last 3 years. They have increased enforcement in their southern border. There are literally camps of hundreds and sometimes even thousands of people in southern Mexico. They're doing their best to get people to not go far past southern Mexico. And just this week, their immigration agency has been sending out press releases with pictures of people that they are putting on planes and sending to their countries of origin. So on Monday, they sent a plane full of people to Cuba. And then on Tuesday, they sent a plane full of people to San Pedro Sula, which is the second biggest city in Honduras. And then again this morning, they sent another plane to Honduras. So Mexico says that at least publicly, I think they're trying to do their best to say, like, hey, we're doing as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, this will affect the business community. How are those stakeholders reacting to all of this?
Yeah, I think that part of what's interesting about this is that the reason why this immigration issue, which has been an issue for many years, is front and center this week and at the top of the agenda is because President Trump is putting like economic repercussions to it. And as you probably won't be surprised to hear, I haven't been able to hear from like a single business leader who says that this is actually a good idea. So I called Guillermo Valencia. There's no relation, by the way, but I called Guillermo Valencia. He is the president of Valencia International, which is a brokerage firm in Nogales. They basically help companies import products from Mexico. And he's saying that just the mere threat of the tariffs immediately impacted his work and the work of many people.
I have 22 million packages of grapes that are going to be coming in from Sonora in this season, and they want to know how much duty they're going to be paying and how to pay it. And I don't have details.
And just to add a little bit more to what Valencia was saying, last night I was on the phone with a manufacturer from a company in Puebla here in central Mexico. They make slings for belts. I mean, one of their clients is the Los Angeles Police Department. They're a small company, but they produce them at a large scale. They have about 20 employees. And so what he's saying is that perhaps a large company such as Walmart, they could perhaps absorb the cost of a 5% tariff. But smaller companies, they probably will not. And if those tariffs go to from 5 to 10%, that could possibly put a lot of people just straight up out of business.
So over the years, Governor Doug Ducey here in Arizona has gone out of his way to publicly promote commerce between Arizona and Mexico and Sonora in particular. So how is this affecting our state's relationship with Mexico?
Well, things have gotten tense because Governor Ducey, as he has done with many other issues, is backing the president. I think his office put out a statement saying something to the effect that basically what is happening right now is a difficult situation, but they're not really going very strongly in one way or the other. Now, his counterpart in Sonora, which is the state that borders us in Arizona, Governor Claudia Pavlovich, she very publicly came out and said that she fully supports the Mexican president and whatever the Mexican government is doing to lobby in Washington. Now, the thing is that the relationship between Arizona and Sonora over the years, or Arizona and Mexico overall, over the years, there's been a back and forth. And SB 1070, as you might recall, was something that put a lot of strain in that relationship. And a lot of people here still remember. And Governor Ducey and also his counterparts at the city level, the mayors, have put a lot of effort over the years to increase commerce because Mexico is Arizona's number one trading partner. And so they see that as a good thing for companies where, you know, in Arizona or in their cities. One former mayor is now a member of Congress, Greg Stanton, and I spoke to him about this, and he called this proposal self-defeating.
So I'm going to consistently use my voice to make it clear that this is bad national policy, but particularly bad policy for a border state like Arizona.
Just to add to that, in Congress, there seemed to be increasing support among Republicans, especially in the Senate, which is the key chamber here, to stop the president from implementing these tariffs. So there's Democrats and also a lot of Republicans who are trying to stop this. And we'll find out more about where these negotiations go. They're going to have meetings again at the executive level at some point today. So hopefully, at least by the end of today, we'll have a little bit more of a clear picture about whether or not this is going to happen next Monday.
All right. That's KJZZ's Jorge Valencia from our Mexico City Bureau. Jorge, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Lauren.
And now we turn to the nation's capital, where many senators, including a number of Republicans, have come out against President Trump's threatened tariffs against Mexico. Arizona Republican Martha McSally says she's against the tariffs, but adds action needs to be taken at the border.
Well, a few weeks ago, I joined my friend, Senator Lindsey Graham, in introducing the Secure and Protect Act of 2019. This important legislation closes gaps in current law that have led to an escalating number of people crossing our southern border. As we know, in Arizona, this is a humanitarian and a security crisis. It has become a national emergency.
In order to get a veto-proof majority to prevent the implementation of the tariffs, every Democrat, the two independents who caucus with Democrats, plus at least 18 Republicans, would have to officially vote against the president's wishes. So what are the chances? With me to talk about the politics behind all of this is Jordan Fabian, White House correspondent for The Hill. Jordan, is the president facing enough solid support from GOP senators to make any difference in whether the tariffs go forward?
Well, he is facing a lot of opposition from Republican senators, but it might not be enough to actually block him from imposing these tariffs. So Republicans in the Senate right now are discussing legislation that would disapprove of these tariffs and prevent him from doing this kind of thing in the future. The problem is that it does not appear right now, and this is according to Republican senators we've spoken to, that he has the 67 votes needed to override a possible veto from the president. So any measure of disapproval the Senate might pass would appear to be only symbolic at this point.
So he would need, there would need to be about 35 to 40% then of Republican senators who would want to do this. Is there a feeling that there is any momentum at all, or does it feel like maybe there are 10 or 12 and everyone else is really saying, I'm not going to take on the president this way?
Well, I'll give you an example. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who's a big outspoken opponent of these tariffs, actually told the Mexican ambassador this week that it does not appear that they will eventually get the votes to override this veto. So this is coming from someone who desperately wants to block these tariffs. So that gives you an indication that while it appears there was some momentum earlier this week that Republicans might do something to block these tariffs, it doesn't appear they will be able to do so.
Is the party generally concerned about these tariffs, both from the standpoint of optics, but also in reality? Are they concerned it could slow the economy? And so are they trying behind the scenes to convince the president and his advisors to just not go ahead with this on Monday?
Yeah, publicly and privately, Republican senators have told the administration and the president not to go ahead with these tariffs. But, you know, the president is very headstrong on this issue, and he appears determined to be going forward. And I can tell you that Republican senators are not only concerned about the economy, the U.S. economy, and what this might do, what these tariffs might do to it, but they're also concerned about this pending U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement that the Congress still has to ratify. The fear is that by imposing tariffs on Mexico, that might slow the approval process down there, and it could also slow the approval process down here as well. And so that trade deal, which is really the president's biggest legislative item at this point, would appear to be put on ice, they fear, if these tariffs go into place.
Well, so what's the reality at this point? I know it's only Thursday, we say at this point, but these tariffs could go into effect as soon as Monday, and then they really ramp up as time goes by. 5% sounds like nothing compared to what the president seems to have in mind.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea, Steve, of the scope of this, you know, Mexico recently became the U.S. largest trading partner, and last year the U.S. imported $346.5 billion in goods from Mexico. So you're talking about a 5% tax on all of those items. It would certainly hit a state like Arizona hard and many other states across the U.S., and we're talking everything from, you know, automotives to, you know, food, agricultural products, and you know, retail products, stuff you'd find in the clothing store. So there is a broad recognition here that this could have a huge effect on the economy. And, you know, Mexican officials are here in Washington this week to try and engage in talks with the administration to stop these tariffs. Those talks are continuing today, but that's only happening at the staff level. You know, remember, the president's still in Europe. So the fear is that while they could make progress today, the final decider, the president, is not around to really make the call.
Jordan, is there a feeling, the word that came to mind for me was measurables, because the president has tied undocumented immigration to these tariffs. Is there a feeling that there's certain amount of progress he and the administration have to see, or is that sort of up in the air?
Very much up in the air, Steve. And in fact, the administration has sent a lot of mixed signals on what exactly Mexico would need to do to avoid these tariffs. You know, of course, they've mentioned issues like Mexico securing its southern border with Guatemala, you're doing more to combat criminal gangs. But then you have yesterday, you know, the White House top trade advisor, Peter Navarro, come out and say, well, these tariffs might not even go into place because the point was to get Mexico's attention. And then last week, you also had Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney at the White House say, you know, this is going to be decided on an ad hoc basis. So I think there's been a lot of confusion on the Mexican side and also on Capitol Hill about what exactly Mexico would need to do to stop this from going into place. And you know, we've asked administration officials repeatedly what they would need to do, and we've only gotten vague answers at best.
Jordan Fabian is White House correspondent for The Hill. The clock ticks for Monday to see if whether these tariffs against Mexico get implemented. Jordan, thanks for the time this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Today, the VA's Mission Act officially goes into effect. It's intended to give veterans more options on health care decisions, in part by streamlining the VA's Community Cares program. But critics remain concerned about whether veterans are being served on a timely basis, and when they are, if the medical attention they're receiving is good enough. And are those big problems discovered initially at the Phoenix VA getting significantly smaller? Earlier, I spoke with VA Secretary Robert Wilkie about those subjects and more. I began by asking for more details about the Mission Act and how big a step it is for the department and veterans.
Well, it's a big step in that it is part of an overall transformative trend at VA that includes everything from the supply chain to HR reform, the formation of an electronic health record. What Mission does is it is, I think, hopefully, the final response to what happened in Arizona. It's one of the things that I promised my friend Senator McCain that I would carry on. I was more recently the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. I was acting the last time that I was acting Secretary of VA the last time I talked to him, and I said that I would make sure that Phoenix never happened again. My focus is actually on rural America and Native America here. It's the two groups that have the highest per capita participation in the armed forces, the two groups that have the highest per capita award of the Medal of Honor, and for Native America, probably a group that has never received the attention that it deserves. So what does Mission do in those areas? One, it says that if you live a certain distance from a VA facility and we cannot provide you a service that you need within a certain number of days, then we will give you the option, and only the option, of going into the private sector. This is not libertarian VA. This is not giving a card to a veteran with the word veteran on it and sending that veteran out into the private sector to look forth and prosper. If we can't give you something, we will provide that service in the private sector. The Mission Act, it consolidates the seven different payment systems or plans that existed under Choice and consolidates them into one so that we pay those community hospitals and small town doctors what they are owed.
There are so many more veterans than there have been over the past decade or so, and there's an increased commitment that has had to be made to care for them in the proper way. And I wonder, where do you think mental health care fits into all of that?
Well, that is, I think, and I'm not a medical professional. My background is defense, both in uniform and then I was General Mattis's Undersecretary of Defense. But I see it. I see mental health. We're not even at the Sputnik stage when it comes to getting our arms around mental health, but that is the last great frontier in medicine. I'm firmly convinced we will find a cure for cancer before my children reach the age of 40, and they're both teenagers now. Mental health, we're not anywhere near that. Our VA budget has $9.5 billion in it for mental health services, but we suffer from the same shortages that the rest of America suffers from. We were only able to hire 3,900 mental health professionals last year. I would like to see 6, 7, 8,000. One thing that I've talked about across the country is the need for a continued change in the culture. My father's era, it was not acceptable to talk about fears. It was not acceptable to talk about trauma. There has to be a new day, that we have to encourage soldiers to talk about this. We have to encourage soldiers to tell us if they see signs of problems in their comrades. I could not have said that 20 or 30 years ago. I would have been drummed out of whatever forum I happen to be speaking to. I will add to your question that the greatest challenge that I think America has is the issue of suicide. We lose 20 veterans a day. One or two of those veterans is on active duty. Another three, perhaps four, are in the Guard and Reserve and have never deployed. But the majority, 14 out of those 20, we have no contact with. And more than half of that 14, about eight, are from the Vietnam era. And we need a national conversation on mental health and suicide.
We know that when it came down from finding out about the situation at the VA hospitals, which started in Phoenix, some of that had to do with whistleblowing, which is in some cases how change is made.
Right.
Right.
Are there protections that should be in effect for that, especially because when you have a bureaucracy and people who don't want to lose their position necessarily, they will react poorly to that. And yet, ultimately, it may in fact help the system. How do you balance that out?
Well, we balance it out by reminding our employees as well as the country, there are more mechanisms to come forward here at VA than in any other cabinet department, including the Department of Defense. We have the General Counsel. We have the Inspector General. We have the Office of Medical Investigations, and we have the Office of Accountability and Whistleblower Protection. We ask people to come forward, and those are four avenues that they can use. Now, the other side of the accountability office that the president allowed us to set up is that we are now able to move faster when it comes to removing employees who are a threat because of their performance to the folks that we serve. I certainly have encouraged people to come forward. Now, I will also say what I've said in testimony. Not everyone who claims the mantle of whistleblower is a real whistleblower. And we've got well over 1,000 investigations going on now. And there's a chunk of that that is not accurate. But we look at everything.
Overall, we know that throwing money at things doesn't fix a problem. But when it comes to making the VA better, if you had your druthers, would more money help?
Well, it does. And let me tell you what I've just been through. I've just been through the budget cycle. I have presented the largest budget in the history of this department, $220 billion. Yes, in this case, the money is needed. But I'll go back to something that I said earlier. To me, culture is just as important, if not more important than money. I think the reason why VA is doing well now, why we have great customer satisfaction rates, is because we understand the uniqueness of military culture. But on other issues, like suicide and mental health, I don't know that you can come up with enough money without addressing the cultural trends that affect those Americans, that impact those Americans for whom taking of life is the last measure. It's a measure of sadness and desperation. That's where we need to have a cultural conversation.
And that is VA Secretary Robert Wilkie.
This is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein. Still to come, we'll talk to the Health Department Director about concerns over a potential measles outbreak in our state. And we're doing things a little differently this summer from 9 until 10. Now until Labor Day, we are focusing on Arizona Stories, regional stories. The Takeaway will air from 10 until 11 as we follow this summer schedule. So keep sending us those great story ideas. We are at the show at KJZZ.org.
After months of helping asylum-seeking migrants, some nonprofits say it's time for the city of Phoenix to take action. KJZZ's Christina Estes joins me now to talk about what happened during yesterday's council meeting. So, Christina, you heard from women involved with two different groups, right?
I did. As migrants are processed and given a court date, federal authorities have been releasing them to family members or dropping them off at shelters or near bus stations. It's the bus station location that really bothers the two women who spoke out yesterday. First, you'll hear from Sarah Erie. She coordinates the Asylum Seekers Program for Lutheran Social Services of the Southwest.
When a church doesn't offer shelter, people are relegated to the ditch on 24th and Buckeye. And what we're saying is that this is not an acceptable alternative.
The ditch she mentions is the water retention basin near the Greyhound bus station, where authorities have been releasing some migrants as they wait for their cases to make it through the system. If someone is dropped off and doesn't have a ticket, they can't hang out at the bus station. And that worries Carolyn O'Connor. She's with a coalition called Uncage and Reunite Families.
They are forced to sit on the ground in the heat. Often refugees that arrive are dehydrated and hungry. As the temperature continues to rise, we are concerned this is a fatality waiting to happen.
She asked council members to come up with an air-conditioned facility to serve as an intake center, at least through the summer. Sarah Erie wants Phoenix to pass an ordinance banning the federal government from releasing people without a place to stay. She says nonprofits and volunteers are at the breaking point.
I want you to know that this coalition is collapsing under the strain. We are losing churches every day, and we are not able to replace them. And I'm telling you, we are weeks away from an emergency.
Erie also asked the council to create a committee to address the issue and come up with a plan so immigration authorities don't continue to drop off people at the bus station who may not have money to get anywhere.
Christine, I think it's significant to have you explain why these statements are so important.
Sure. There have been behind-the-scenes meetings between various elected officials or their representatives and the groups that have been providing food, shelter, and transportation to migrant families. Some groups have been saying those meetings basically end with a city, county, or state government person saying, yes, yes, we know it's a terrible situation, but this is a federal issue. Now, for the first time, those people are publicly saying to Phoenix leaders, this cannot continue. You have to do something.
And did anyone from the city respond to that?
No, at least not yet. Because the requests were not related to an item on the agenda, the council could not directly address them. But both women say they'll continue reaching out to city, county, and state leaders.
That is KJZZ's Christina Estes. Good to talk to you. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Last week, two people died as a result of an outbreak of hepatitis A in our state. The outbreak has been growing since the fall and is up to 339 cases, according to the Arizona Department of Health Services. The viral disease is threatening our growing homeless populations in Arizona and has spread to two inmates in Arizona correctional facilities. For more on how serious this is, I spoke with Dr. Kara Chris, director of the Arizona Department of Health Services, about this, as well as growing concerns over a potential measles outbreak here.
So this is part of a nationwide outbreak. It is relatively serious. The rate of hospitalization that we are seeing among these patients is above 80% of the cases. So people are getting sick, and it is impacting very specific populations in Arizona. And in trying to address this, it has been kind of a all hands on deck approach.
Right. So give us a sense of how this is spreading. This is mostly among the homeless population or the nearly homeless population, correct?
Right. So what we're seeing it in is our homeless population, those that have a history of using illicit drugs, but not just injection drugs, and then those that are either currently or recently incarcerated.
So there is a vaccine for hepatitis A, right? But obviously this is a challenge then to get it to those people. Are you having any success getting that out to this population?
So our local county health departments have been engaged, especially in Pima and Maricopa, which were two of the counties primarily impacted by this outbreak. And so they are out in the community and in the correctional settings trying to vaccinate people that are at high risk, because there is a very effective vaccine for hepatitis A. It's more difficult, though, when you have people that don't have established living, don't have established health care, because you have to go out and meet them where they are. Mm-hmm. And so that can make vaccinating this population a lot more challenging.
And there are those two doses, correct?
There are two doses. In a outbreak situation, one dose is considered 95% effective. So if we were only able to reach somebody and give them the one dose, while we'd prefer to, the one dose should adequately protect them.
So you've said this is also probably only the beginning of this outbreak. Why is that?
So hepatitis A is a very difficult disease once it's in an outbreak situation, because it's got a long incubation period. So it's not like you get exposed and then 3 or 4 days later, you're coming down with the illness. It can be up to 45 days before you start showing signs. So it's not as easy to stay on top of, especially when you're looking at a transient population that will move with the seasons, will move with the weather, or even move day to day. So it makes it a little bit more difficult to get out in front of, because ultimately, to control any type of outbreak, whether it's measles or hepatitis A or a salmonella outbreak, you have to get ahead of the disease so that you are vaccinating those before they get exposed so that you prevent ongoing cases.
So you say this is all hands on deck, right? What does that mean in terms of how different organizations and your department are working to try and stop this?
So the local health departments are always the first line of defense in Arizona. So they are on the ground. They're working with their correctional facilities. They're going out and doing vaccination events out in the community and working with partners that serve those populations. At the state level, what we're doing is we're working with statewide associations so that, like, emergency rooms know that if somebody who is homeless shows up in an emergency room for any reason, offer them the vaccine. Mm-hmm. We're working with Access so that we can ensure that that population is getting enrolled in Access and getting covered so that they can receive the vaccine that they need. Mm-hmm. And so we've really been doing a lot of messaging and a lot of coordinating with partners so that people are aware of this outbreak and are taking the appropriate steps when they are working with this population so that they can provide them the prevention tools they need. Mm-hmm.
I also want to talk to you about the ongoing concern in the state about the measles outbreak that's been happening in other parts of the country. So first of all, where do we stand right now? Like, how many cases of measles have we been able to confirm in the state or have been presented in the state from elsewhere?
So for 2019, we've had two confirmed cases of measles. One was in a resident in Arizona, and the other one was a traveler who visited in Arizona. We got extremely lucky that there were no secondary cases from the exposures. And so right now we are not aware of any measles cases in Arizona communities.
Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of concern about this. There was a recent report that said Maricopa County is particularly vulnerable to a measles outbreak. We're looking at rates of vaccinations. We've talked about this before, but what give us a sense of some of the struggles that your department faces in getting Arizonans vaccinated.
So that is one of the department's major concerns. When we look at vaccination rates across Arizona in our school-age children, we are seeing decreased vaccination rates, especially in our measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. We know that in order to get community immunity, you have to have 95% of the population vaccinated. And the reason we want that is because there are specific groups that measles can be deadly to who cannot get the vaccine. Arizona in 60% of our counties is not at the threshold to have a community immunity. And we know that only 4 out of 10 kindergarten classrooms in Arizona are adequately protected. So this is a concern because measles is so infectious that if you walk into a room and just breathe the air after someone who's contagious with measles is in it, and you are not vaccinated, you have a 9 out of 10 chance of coming down with measles.
And this is most affecting young kids, right? That's the population under, like, infants especially, who cannot be vaccinated.
Right. So the recommended age for your first measles vaccine is 12 to 15 months. But we know that infants have a higher rate of complications when it comes to measles, things like pneumonia or swelling of the brain that could ultimately result in their death. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's so important that the community provide that protection around those that can't get it.
And I know you've been doing a lot of education around this for quite some time, but what are the reasons that people don't get their kids vaccinated? Is it all just misinformation or are there some legitimate concerns out there?
So a lot of it is misinformation. People aren't going to, like, they're not coming to the health department to get their information. They're not going to local health departments. And there is a lot of misinformation out on the web that people may be exposed to. The other thing that we feel may be playing a role is public health has done such a great job of getting these diseases eradicated in the United States. So, like, if I talk to my mom, she remembers her cousin who had polio. She remembers measles in her community. I've never had measles, an outbreak like that in the community that's mm-hmm. impacted my children or my family. So you tend to forget the dangers of that disease. And now you're faced with a vaccine that there's misinformation out about, and that seems like it's more risky than the actual disease.
So what do you think needs to be done? I mean, is this something that needs to go beyond education and toward, you know, regulating this?
You know, our preference is that everyone who can be vaccinated with measles vaccine should be vaccinated. We will continue to do education because we know that there are parents out there who just don't have the appropriate information.
Do you have a sense that we might be at risk because of this? Like, is the health department on high watch saying, like, we don't have enough people vaccinated and this could very well happen here?
Yes. So we do believe that Arizona, including Maricopa County, is at risk for a measles outbreak. And we know that measles is circulating not only in other parts of the world now, but within the United States. So it's just a plane ride away.
I want to ask about the concerns that you hear from the community. I mean, we hear a lot about parents who are skeptical or worried about vaccines and who choose to not vaccinate their children. But do you hear from the other side as well about parents who, you know, have small infants who can't be vaccinated and are worried about bringing them out?
Absolutely. So we do hear a lot of stories from both sides, both from the side that they don't want to vaccinate their children to the side where they can't get their child vaccinated and they are pleading with the community to provide that protection for their child. You know, I can speak from this from a medical perspective, as a physician, as a public health professional, and as a mother. My three children are fully immunized. And I had my littlest one at Disneyland during the exposure of measles when she was only 5 months old. Mm. And it is scary to think that I, knowing the risks, you know, could have put my child in danger. Luckily, she was fine, but I can't imagine having a child who is critically ill.
Yeah.
And thinking that they could come down with this disease.
All right. That's Dr. Kara Crist, Director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. Dr. Crist, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Jean, and I'm at the Riparian Preserve in Gilbert. And this is my first place that I came to when I moved here. It's a great place to begin birding.
Well, welcome to the Water Ranch. This is a wonderful site. I hope it will be one of many visits here. It's about 110 acres.
It's a perfect mindfulness activity. I can't bird without being completely present. Listening, the listening is really important to me.
Just in case it pops up.
Oh, it's really pretty.
Oh, that's cute. Oh, yes. Song sparrows are all over the country. They don't sound the same. There are regional accents for birds, which I know sounds kind of crazy, but it's true. But that cadence is very similar all over the country. That
That's Jean Genoux on a bird walk with Kathy Anderson at the Riparian Preserve in Gilbert. If you have suggestions or think the show is just quacking you up, then send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. The Tony Awards are the occasion to honor excellence in live Broadway theater. And like any huge awards ceremony that features performers, the red carpet is almost as important as the event going on inside Radio City Music Hall on Sunday. An Arizona designer will see his fashions make their inaugural appearance on the aforementioned red carpet when ASU's Colleen Jennings-Rogensack is able to answer Lauren Aragon and Akonov when asked, "Who are you wearing?" And Lauren Aragon is with me to talk about his work. All right, Lauren, so does Colleen have any say in what she wears? Or as the designer, are you basically telling her what it's going to look like?
This is my work, and they became really big fans instantly when they looked at my website. One of the gals, one of her assistants followed me on Instagram, and she knew about my accolades and the things that I've been up to in the valley, and she was the one that reached out to me and said, these are some designs that I showed Colleen and she really loves these, so what can we do? Unfortunately, everything I have is a sample size and a runway size, so really petite sizes, but I work made to order, so this is good timing, perfect, everything was in line, and I said, we're going to make something for you. We're going to make something unique. And I've actually been sitting on this one design for a while. It just was only made it to a sketch at that point. And we basically brought that one to life. And with some things that she liked from two designs that she was really, you know, dead set on wanting to wear. Yeah. So we made this custom piece for her.
Is the design kind of going to be debuted that night? Or can you give us some idea of what it might look like?
I can give you some ideas. So basically, a lot of my influence comes from the Acoma pottery art culture, like I said, and it's mostly black on white clay pot designs, very geometric and fine line patterns. I like to say that we're the fine china of the Pueblo pottery arts, and a lot of those designs represent things in nature and just basically life all around us. And so taking my take on my own designs and putting them into the fashion to be a wearable art form, I do a lot of that. And basically these designs are just just a representation of everything that's living and beautiful around us, and really trying to instill the ideas of empowerment and strength in everything that I make. So this piece is strong with the color of red behind it, and the red represents an homage to ancestry, and also it's also an awareness generator for the missing and murdered indigenous women movement, which is mm-hmm. pretty strong right now and something that we stand behind.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like the culture, your upbringing, is extremely inspirational to you, and it comes from all different aspects of this. Does that come across even as you are in your creative mode and putting it together? Is it something that's sort of ever present with you just because it is within you? Or is there sort of an individual inspiration with each design you do?
It's a little bit of both, but largely it's always with me. I grew up in a good balance of both traditional and modern upbringing. My grandfather was always hard on keeping me in tune with our traditional practices, ceremonies, feasts, and things of that nature, and our language especially. And I think that all of those things that he taught me and just looking back and reaching back to my community where I'm from keeps me tied with a lot of that. I had a lot of grandmothers who did pottery growing up, and my mother and my aunt were seamstresses. So that's where the influence sort of fashion side of things come from. And I really didn't think I would be touching fabric and doing sewing myself. I always thought that was a girly thing to do. And my grandfather was really strict on me to get a career in something promising, which is what I did. And I came out of ASU with a degree in mechanical engineering. Did that for a few years, but, you know, cashed in all my chips and took on fashion as a full-time thing, which we've been doing for the last 3 years now.
There are certain designers, certain companies that have been called into question legally and culturally for appropriation or for simply using the designs in a way that really isn't respectful, let's say. Did that inspire you in any way to say, listen, I have a great eye for this. I care about this a lot as well. So it's not just the business side, it's also the emotional and cultural side to almost counter what you've seen in other places.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of battled that blindly in the beginning, really not knowing what appropriation was. Or obviously, I did see a lot of things that were taking place, and it was a disrespectful display of the cultural attire or some cultural artifact to a lot of different tribes. I took it on coming aboard to it. I really wanted to see and give an identity to fashion as far as Native fashion goes. My mother and my aunt used a lot of fabrics that were Native-inspired or Southwest-inspired. They were labeled as such, but it was just a hodgepodge of a lot of different designs, a lot of different cultures, and not really specific to one. So I thought to myself, what would be great it was if we could design our own fabrics and have them representative of Acoma Pueblo or of a certain Pueblo or tribe and use that in fashion. And with the help of a fellowship 1 year, I took that on and said, I'm going to try my own fabrics and see what we can do with this. And the response was exactly what I wanted. People recognized it. And that was just the start in Santa Fe and back in New Mexico. People saw what I was trying to do and saw that the designs were absolutely Pueblo, absolutely New Mexico, Acoma Pueblo. And I think that was the inspiration behind the whole thing. But I always stand for us Native Americans, designers, artists to step forth, get out of our comfort zones of our own communities mm-hmm. and show people what we're about. And taking part in every right to show my work on the same runways as Dior, as Versace, and being the educator, being the person to tell people, hey, look, we're still around. We're still a culture that does not need to be honored by outside sources. We have every right to honor ourselves and our people and showcase our work to everyone and tell people that we're still here, we're thriving, and we're very much a part of this world as you are, and here's what we have to offer.
Lauren Aragon of ACONAV. Lauren, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
The Tony Awards, including Aragon's designs on the red carpet, are Sunday night in New York. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.